Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Back in the day, artist, naturalist, and author Julie Zickafoos routinely shared her stories about the deer that visited her 80-acre sanctuary in the Appalachian foothills of southern Ohio. There was Ellen, Buffy, Pinky, Jolene, and other gentle souls whom Zickafoos often described in painstaking detail because that's how closely she observes. And then they were gone. Zickafoos speculates that nearby neighbors have attracted away the deer with corn feeders and then hunted them. She doesn't knock the hunters. At least they've left the land around her naturalized and that gives her hope, but she misses her old friends. She joins us now for a conversation about winter wildlife and her front row seat to the show. Welcome back, Julie Zickafoos.
It's great to be here, Ann. It's good to see your face.
It's good to see you too. The headline on your blog entry about the deer is, quote, whitetail, trophy, food, or friend. And for you, they became friends. And tell us a little bit about the deer you name, the friendships you formed with them from afar.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, from their point of view, I'm just benign. I'm not going to hurt them. And that's about as far as the friendship goes on their end. But I get very wrapped up with their life histories and who's related to who and how to tell them apart. And it just appeals to the sort of close observer in me and the person who wants to know the personal stories of individual wild animals.
Because we do. We just, we paint them with broad brushstrokes. It's just another doe. It's just another young buck walking by.
Yeah, but then once you figure out it's the same one and you can chart maybe the time of day he comes through or who he associates with, it becomes this whole Gombe stream experience where, you know, it's kind of like Jane Goodall and her chimpanzees, you know, and just because they're herbivores and ungulates doesn't mean they aren't interesting and intelligent and incredibly amazing animals.
You shared on Friday that you saw a deer that you thought had been taken, Flag, right? His name is Flag.
Right. Yeah, she was named for the little fawn that the boy adopted in Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' classic book, The Yearling, which was one of the very many formative books that I read. But that one hit me really hard because it was kind of this boy and this fawn against the world. And sometimes that's how I feel. You know, it's like it's pretty tough to be friends with deer in an area where people actually come from all over Ohio to hunt. So it's tough, you know, it's a bad thing to fall in love with is a wild deer.
And it wasn't that way before. I mean, there's been a change of ownership in this property. And like you said in one of your blogs, you appreciate that they're keeping the properties naturalized, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's sort of the ironic thing. I mean, you know, who am I to complain that people are suddenly hunting on three sides of me, actually four sides of me now? When the other choice would be, you know, clear cutting and housing development. So, you know, it's my feelings about hunting are very complex. You know, I realize that we have to control the deer populations or they will take over as they have in many areas because there's a dearth of natural predators. But by the same token, I see an awful lot of coyote predation on fawns and I know that they're efficient natural predators of deer. Yet the same people who hunt the deer, take out coyotes because they, you know, don't want competition.
It's competition,
so,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's frustrating for me to see the natural predatory controls eliminated and trapped out in great numbers. And then, you know, everybody's trying to protect the deer so they can be hunted. So it's when you see big pictures, it's pretty frustrating.
So there's a season for coyotes?
Well, coyotes, I think are unprotected by any season and can be taken year round, as far as I know. I may be corrected by a caller, but I don't think there's any protection for them under Ohio law.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is a special occasion because we have Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, and author of several books, including the 2019 title, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos this hour, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So here's how silly I am. It didn't occur to me that people who want to hunt them would attract them with things like corn and probably salt licks and different things like that, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's it's not legal on public land, but on private land, you just put up a corn feeder and dump large amounts of corn starting in probably September. And the deer get used to coming. In fact, I've observed the feeders make a loud noise when they distribute the corn. And the deer actually come running when they hear that whirring noise that the machine makes. So, wow. So on private land, you can shoot them right over corn, which was something I had to learn when I came to Ohio. I was like, oh, wait, isn't this illegal? But I've learned a lot about how it works.
Is it illegal in some places to do that?
Well, you can't do it on public land.
Right.
Yeah. But on your private land, you certainly can.
And you don't feed them, right?
That's correct. They will come under they used to come under my bird feeders to clean up the spillage. And I will confess that on a super, if it was been cold and icy for a very long time, I would throw out a few handfuls of whole corn. But it's not really good for them to be eating corn in the middle of winter. They're supposed to be eating browse. Their digestive tracts are geared to eating browse.
What's browse?
Browse. Yeah, B-R-O-W-S-E is twigs.
Okay.
Believe it or not, yeah, they're adapted to eating twigs, which have protein and have all kinds of nutrients in them that corn doesn't.
I've noticed, I think it's deer going after some young trees in our neighborhood. You know, we live along the Olentangy River by that big park in Franklin County. There's plenty to eat everywhere else. What is it about the bark?
Oh, they're adapted to eat twigs and they like certain species. They will, where I am, they'll eat the leaves off the honeysuckle in the winter. They really like honeysuckle. So there's a line above which there are no honeysuckle leaves, or below which, that's called the browse line. And you can definitely see it in areas of woods that are heavily populated by deer. You can see like a line where they've reached up into the trees and taken the twigs off. And it's quite amazing, actually. So, I fully recognize that deer get too numerous and there do need to be controls on them. My emotions get in my way when I befriend the deer. So it's kind of a difficult position to be in, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Tiny Tyne was a 10-point buck. Mm-hmm. A sweet prize. You have a picture of him from 2019 on your blog with an 8-point buck, and you noted there that bucks get an undeserved bad rap.
Yeah, I take a lot of what I know about deer from the writings of Joe Hutto, who is an amazing naturalist who lives out west and has studied at very, very close range wild turkeys, bighorn sheep.
We've had him on the show. He did, what was the name of his book? Wow. Yeah.
The Light in High Places is about bighorn sheep, and Touching the Wild is about mule deer. Uh-huh. And Illumination in the Flatwoods is about turkeys.
Yes.
I read Illumination in the Flatwoods right after it came out when I was at a pretty impressionable age. And I just thought, man, this guy is doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
So he's definitely been formative. But back to bucks. Joe has discovered in mule deer that bucks retain an attachment to their mothers. And love to hang around with them, and that they're very emotional animals. And they kind of get portrayed in popular media as these sex crazed machines who go racing around,
during rutting season
in their path. Right.
Yeah.
In order to get to a doe. And while they will have periods of inattention when they're preoccupied with a doe, and a buck will trot right past you, snorting as he goes after her, they aren't, they aren't the automatons that they're made out to be.
One of the deer that you're pretty sure that didn't survive was Buffy. And that makes me so sad how you recognized her remains.
Yeah. My dog brought her tail home from a pile of carcasses. And that was very hard. She had a bright red, fox red tail. And I held it in my hand and thought, should I save this? And I was like, no, this makes me too sad. So I buried her tail. Buffy was an old soldier, and she, I guess I followed her for probably 9 or 10 years. And she was funny. She was built like a dachshund. She had a long body and a very short leg, so I could recognize her at a great distance, but she was all over Buffy colored, hence her name. My names are not creative. They're just based on how the tiny tine was about an antler tine. They're just based on how the animal looks, which is the way I feel they should be named. But yeah, Buffy was wonderful, and she took over Ellen's twins when Ellen was killed at a great age. And she essentially raised them from about 5 months of age on, which was just an amazing thing to see. But she and Buffy, Ellen and Buffy were inseparable, so it kind of figures that Buffy would adopt Ellen's twins.
As far as Bucks being attached to their mothers, anybody who's watched Bambi knows that.
Well, heck yeah.
Julie, come on.
There's truth in Disney. There's a lot of truth in Disney.
Someone did their homework.
Right.
The deer around us, you know, sometimes look really skinny, not well fed, and hunters would say that they're thinning the herd. Mm-hmm. That probably isn't the case around you if they're feeding them, right?
Well, they do get fed all winter in the area, and you know, they are definitely thinning the herd, and it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to emphasize that because it's you put yourself up for a lot of attack if you come off as anti-hunting.
Sure.
It's impolitic to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that. What I want to do is make it more personal and just sort of explore the difficulty that I have with, you know, just being an inveterate student of nature and being compelled to follow individual animals and then getting very involved. Perhaps I shouldn't, but there's so much to be learned about deer. And I think that they are a misunderstood animal. We know an awful lot about the mechanics of deer. We know about their diseases. We know more about white-tailed deer than probably almost any other animal, because we have these amazing samples every fall where they can go through them organ by organ and find out a lot about them. But I'm not sure we know a great deal about their sentience and their emotions. And that's where I come down. That's what I want to know about.
That's true of how we view most animals, isn't it? Except for maybe, you know, apes. And you know, you mentioned Jane Goodall and her relationship with gorillas and things like that. But, yeah, we make a lot of assumptions, don't we?
Well, especially if we eat them. And you know, I think if you've paid attention lately, that the press coming out on octopus as a sentient being is absolutely astonishing.
I'd love to be talking to Cy Montgomery right now, right?
No kidding. I'd love to be talking to Cy anytime.
You know? Right. Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. I've given her book, The Soul of an Octopus, to a bunch of people. Because, you know, here's this thing that we know as pulpo, or, you know, just something on a plate, little rings. And yet there's this marvelous brain in this animal that may live only 2 years. And that's the thing about octopus that completely blows my mind. Why waste such a precious intellect on an animal with such a short lifespan? Because generally, in biology, we're conditioned to associate intelligence with longevity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, elephants, apes, ravens, eagles, parrots especially. You know, the longer lived a creature is, the more intelligent it's likely to be. But octopus just kind of breaks the whole paradigm.
Is it they're limited to 2 years? Refresh my memory on that. Just is it because of the environment or because their constitution?
Yeah, it's their life cycle. The giant Pacific octopus is sort of programmed to mate and lay this big mass of eggs and die. At 2 years old, it's like a spider, you know? It's like,
She's
like Charlotte making the egg ball and then she dies. And I don't understand it, but there you go. But, you know, you've got these octopi in laboratory situations, literally like sneaking out of their tanks and crawling into other tanks that they want to investigate. And then before the researchers come in the next morning, like going back to their tanks and like shutting the lid, you know, they'll never know I've done this. You know?
Luckily, there are such a thing as remote control cameras.
The nanny cam is going to grab your octopus ninja all the time. Is
We are talking about the wild. My guest is Julie Zicafus. She's a naturalist, artist, and author of several books. including the 2019 titles Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck J. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about nature and wildlife in the wintertime with author, artist, and naturalist Julie Zickafoos. She has a front row seat from her home in the Appalachian foothills of southern Ohio. If you have a question or comment for Julie, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, we were talking earlier about how, you know, cameras captured octopuses sneaking out of their tanks and going to another tank at research facilities and then getting back in thinking no one can see them. You have a trail cam that takes photos and gives you real-time alerts. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's the coolest thing. It's made by Moultrie, the camera, and I actually got the setup through Wingscapes, which is a company run by a dear friend of mine named Bart Stevens. What it does is it sends an alert to my cell phone when something walks by the game camp, which is so cool because like, here comes this bobcat, you know, at 11 in the morning, and I can get a thumbnail photo on my cell phone of this bobcat walking by my camera. So it's just wonderful. The absolute best was this summer. I had a bobcat carrying a still kicking gray squirrel past the camera.
Oh my gosh.
Which was just, you know, and I sent it to my sisters and one of them was like, it's got kittens. And I was like, not with a tail like that.
No.
Yeah.
The animal kingdom in 3D.
Yeah.
How do you pick where you put the cam?
I just put it in a high traffic area. I mow paths through this big meadow and the animals like to walk on clear paths just like people do. And so I have it sort of near a junction of two paths and that seems to be a really good spot. I don't put anything out there to attract them. I just want to know what's going by naturally. And you know, last year I had a pair of gray foxes, which are becoming extremely rare in Ohio. They're undergoing a tremendous decline, perhaps linked to competition with red foxes and especially coyotes, which have exploded in the state. So, you know, you pull one thread and the whole tapestry can unravel. And gray foxes seem to be getting the hard side of coyote expansion.
I've been following your updates on Facebook with the titmouse named Tim.
Yeah.
And I was sorry to read that he didn't make it. And you sort of apologized for conversing with your readers in the first place about it, but it's kind of part of it, isn't it? The life and the death.
It is, except that when you have a blog that a lot of people read, you're making life so much harder for yourself by announcing that you have this adorable creature in your care, you know, who may or may not make it. And I jumped the gun on this one. I really had a lot of hope that this bird, which I think had brain trauma, would pull out of it. And so I introduced him to the blogosphere and too early, and he went the other way. I think a lot of people value, though, knowing something of what happens in wildlife rehab, and they understand that heartbreak is part of it. And so, you know, I have this whole post of all these little videos of him being able to do all kinds of great stuff, and then he went downhill anyway. So I won't post that one because that's really too heartbreaking. But I do think there's a value in letting people in on the story.
He had his head was inverted, which means, yeah. What? I mean,
Well, it's called torticollis, and the neck is completely twisted, so the bird is literally, its head is upside down.
Okay.
And there can be a number of causes for that, and I don't know without an autopsy, or necropsy, I'm sorry, what actually caused it. But the most likely thing is that he was probably frightened into a window by a passing hawk or something, and bumped his head real hard and had brain swelling, which can cause torticollis. There are other things that can cause it. In chickens, it can be caused by Newcastle disease. It can also be caused, oddly enough, by a parasite carried by opossums called Sarcocystis. And there's lots of opossums around. So I probably won't know what caused it.
How did you, you know, it's, we always need want to take a minute in these conversations to talk about the idea that don't try this at home, right?
Yeah. I mean, I should always say I'm a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, licensed by the state and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to handle wildlife. I've even got my rabies vector permit, which means I can house bats over the winter, which I often wind up doing. They are the most fascinating mammals, I think, that exist. They are absolutely incredible. They've broken the flight barrier that only, you know, we think of only birds as being able to fly. Bats have true flight, flapping flight, and highly intelligent, sensitive, long-lived. Bats can live up to 35 years. And, you know, so deserving of respect and, I think, adoration. So I really enjoy working with bats and introducing them to people who whose first response would be eek.
Mm-hmm. So when you find something like Tim the titmouse, what do you do as a caretaker?
Well, first I try to make sure that it's something that I can address, because I'm not a veterinarian. I can't handle broken bones or, you know, internal injuries, anything that would need surgery. I have to pass on to the Ohio Wildlife Center in Columbus. Those people are my heroes. They've taken in over 7,800 individual creatures this season alone.
Wow.
I remember the year when they hit 3,000 and they thought, how can we even do this? And now they've more than doubled that.
Wow.
Probably due to so many people staying home, a lot more people feeding birds in their backyard and noticing, you know, they see the mourning dove sitting around looking miserable for a couple of days instead of never knowing it was there.
So you wrote a book about your rescue of a blue jay named Jemima, that you named Jemima, I should say,
yeah.
in 2019 book titled Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. That story continues to resonate. You gave a public talk just last week about it. And I'm wondering how it's resonating with readers, you know, now 3 years or going, I'm sorry, going on 3 years. Later, the book's got legs.
I still get these lovely notes from people who have just read it and, you know, who just want to say how much they love it. And it really gives me the desire to put out another book.
Yeah.
I have so many ideas of what I want to write next. And I really tend toward the essay. You know, my wheelhouse is the 1700 word, you know, essay. And I think there's a freedom in losing one's publisher. And now kind of the way I want to do it is to write the book and then say, hey, who likes this? As opposed to having a marketing person at a large publisher tell me, oh, that will never sell. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like that. I think I'm going to enjoy that creative freedom. And I have a number of essays that I haven't published anywhere that I think would come into a really nice collection, like Letters from Eden 2, perhaps. I have one essay I just love called You Must Really Want That Skull.
What's that about?
It's years ago, my little Boston Terrier took off at our dead run through the woods and wound up at the carcass of a very large buck deer who was had died of a disease that's carried by midges that kills them in the late summer and early autumn. And you always find them sprawled in streams because they're trying to drink. It's kind of like blue tongue in sheep, which is something that causes the esophagus to swell and the tongue to swell, so they can't drink. It's pretty bad way to go. Nevertheless, here was this really, really fetid carcass with this beautiful skull. And I wanted that, but I couldn't take it right then because it was too disgusting. So I came back a couple months later with my daughter, who was just at the age where she was making fun of everything I did. And so
as all good daughters should.
Yeah, she perched on a rock quite a distance away and watched me trying to twist this still nauseatingly gross skull off this carcass without the proper tools. And it's very hard actually to separate a skull from a vertebra.
I didn't know. Yeah.
So she at one point suggested that I hold the antlers and twirl the animal over my head until it separated. She said the inappropriate suggestion is one of my secret sources of humor. So I nixed that. And then at one point she said, you must really want that skull. Which I did. So eventually I got the skull, and now I have all my most beautiful jewelry hanging from its antlers in my room. Wow.
You know, that just reminds me of when I was a kid coming home from school one day. And this is back in the olden days when we used to let our dog run around all over the neighborhood. And here she was marching down the street with the big deer head in her jaws, lugging it, dragging it down the street. It must have been someone's garbage or something. They were throwing it out. It was probably around hunting season. And it was horrific, you know, to see this beautiful standard poodle.
And the wolf is intact in that standard poodle, absolutely intact, and will come out at the oddest moment.
I mean, all you could see in her face was score.
Like, look, Ma, look what I got. It really stinks.
Oh, my gosh. Anyone have a question or comment for Julie Zicafoos? Don't wait. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I guess I didn't realize that. I guess I'm starting to see blue jays again. Well, you know, we took our feeders down a lot, pretty much a lot of this summer because of what was going around at the beginning of spring or around springtime. And we weren't sure what was happening with the birds. And we're just getting them put back up now. So I wasn't really paying attention. But blue jays don't really hang around all year long, or...
Blue jays are really kind of episodic in at least Southern Ohio where I live. I don't expect to see them in any numbers until late November, early December. And the magic day was yesterday, December 5th. And I had 5 in my yard at once. And I was like a little kid on Christmas morning because that's my favorite bird. And just to be bathing in blue jays was just so wonderful. So I ran out and constructed my cinder block blue jay feeder that I call Cyano City, and put out. In fact, I have in my car right now, I have a big bag of what's something called buck yum, which is kind of hard to say, but it's a mix of whole corn and peanut halves, and it's really affordable, and the jays are crazy about it. So I put that out for my jays up on feeders.
Love them. How did your time with Jemima help your understanding of blue jays?
Oh my gosh. Well, first I knew that corvids were interesting, but it helps me expect anything from them at any moment. So when a blue jay or a crow or a raven is in my sight, it has my total attention because it's going to be doing something interesting. But I think the thing I love most is that it taught me to recognize individual jays the way the blue jays do, which is by scrutinizing the small details of their faces and their coloration and their markings. And once you can start telling one from another, then the fun begins.
You know, it's been through you and other people that I've interviewed on the show that I've learned how individualistic birds are. You know, we grow up kind of thinking everything's the robin redbreast, blah, blah, blah. Everything's very broad brush strokes, and it's anything but.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you can, you know, I hate to use the word personality, but there's no other word, you know, the birdenality, I guess. The personality of each bird is different from the next. And, you know, if you have one who's bossy or dominant, and you can connect that with its markings, then you start to make a profile of that bird, you know. It's a blast. It's like a video game or something. You know, it's how I amuse myself, is watching jays and seeing how they interact.
Natalie in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, I have a question. I have a bird feeder and I have a family of deer who come nightly. They also love the apples I put out. I have heard feeding deer is bad. I've never heard why. What does the author think about this, and what should I be feeding them? Thank you.
You said you feed them apples?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
they come to the bird feeder, they eat the detritus from that, and then she also feeds them apples.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that when we talk about feeding wildlife, in a consistent way, what we wind up doing is creating an unnatural concentration of the animals at the feeding station. I think we've all heard of, you know, the lady who feeds raccoons, who puts out cat kibble every night, and there are 60 raccoons coming to her porch. That's obviously going to be an unhealthy situation for everyone concerned, especially the raccoons, and any bird that nests in the area. Now, when you start attracting deer and you feed them on a consistent basis, you're going to keep attracting deer and you will add on to the deer that are coming in. And I would think that apples would be something somewhat less bad than corn, which is not really geared for their digestive systems at all. But the outcome of feeding wildlife and getting them dependent on the handout is kind of the same throughout, especially mega wildlife like deer. So, you know, if you're attracting them into your yard, you might be attracting animals that will chew your vegetation and your neighbor's ornamentals and bed down there and then chew some more. So it's one thing to put out a treat. It's quite another to put out 4 bushels of apples every night and then have, you know, 20 deer coming in. So I think that's the bad that we're talking about.
Thanks, Natalie, for that question. We'll get to the other calls and more talk with Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, and author of several books, including the 2019 title Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org with your questions or comments. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. My guest is author, artist, and naturalist Julie Zicafus. She plies her trade largely from her home in the Appalachian foothills of southern Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I say that, obviously you live there, but you travel all over the world in better times, doing what you do and also talking with people. And I'm wondering what your schedule has been like. I mean, is it picking up? What's happening with you?
I have no schedule. Okay. Somebody says, are you free April 5? I go, oh yeah, I'm free April 5.
Okay. It's very different now.
Yeah, it's not picking up and very, very different now. Yeah, I actually was asked to go on a fam trip, which is a press trip to Uganda. And they are there right now. And
you are not.
I turned it down on the basis that I didn't want to get stuck in Uganda for an unknown amount of time, as lovely as it is. A good dictum is never travel anywhere you wouldn't want to live for a couple of months, you know, against your will. So I'm just buttoned down as a single mom of two 20 something kids. I feel very keenly my responsibility to stay healthy and sequester. And so I invested in a couple boxes of N95s and I only go out for groceries. So good thing I'm an introvert, works pretty well.
Oh, let's see. We got some calls here. Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I was calling last year, I think it was in early December, and we live in an apartment building on the second floor, and there's a big tree outside of our window. And I noticed like a half a dozen or so birds fly out of the tree and land on the ground. So I went over to the window to look, and it was like a half a dozen or so blue jays. And they look so pretty because when you look down on their backs and you see where their feathers, you know, join their backs, it was this Prussian blue pattern and it looks so pretty. And I was thinking, you know, I haven't seen any cardinals for a while. And I looked over and there was a male and female cardinal off to the side. And then I noticed another group of real small birds fly out of the tree and I looked down and it was chickadees. And it was just like all of them together there. It was just like a living Christmas card. And I know you mentioned earlier that blue jays, I thought you say stay intermittently during the winter, but, and I know cardinals do, and I think chickadees too, but it was just, it was so beautiful to see them all together. It was like a living Christmas card. And then just last week when I looked out the window, and it, we're pretty far up High Street, but again, there are like a half a dozen sort of buildings and parking lots, and there were like four does and a fawn on one of the lawns, and they were waiting to cross the street. And again, it's like when you see that like burst of wildlife like that, it's like I said, it just looked like living Christmas cards. And I thought it was so pretty and was, and I know how you feel about blue jays. So that was it. That was basically what I was calling to.
Thanks, Iris.
Talk about. Thanks, Iris. That's lovely. I think wildlife is a gift, and it's funny how seeing something like that can just make your day. You know, it's, I know exactly what you mean. Your chickadees and cardinals should be resident year round, whereas the blue jays kind of blow in the winter in Ohio. And, you know, they will breed, of course, in suburban neighborhoods and even urban neighborhoods, but in low numbers. To see the bunches of blue jays like you describe, you kind of have to wait until midwinter or early winter to see something like that. Lucky you.
Thank you, Iris. Let's see. Dave in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Actually, it's JB. I was calling because I find it interesting that blue jays and ravens were the favorite birds because as a hunter, we hate those birds.
Because they say, hey, look, there's a hunter.
Yeah, I'll follow you through the whole forest, letting everything know you're coming.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're not dumb.
Well, when I come out to walk the dog in the morning, there's always a bunch of blackbirds of some ilk up in the trees just screaming as we walk out the door. They're out. She's out.
A lot of people have been talking about the big flocks of grackles and starlings that are sweeping through Ohio right now. And I've lived here for 29 years, and I've never seen a phenomenon like this. I wish I had some insight as to what's going on, but it seems that some sort of a flightway has shifted, and now we're being graced by these cackling flocks of grackles and whirring murmurations of starlings. I find it absolutely thrilling. I have my window open even on a cold day so I can listen for them, and so I can go out and experience the sound of the flocks in the woods.
JT, thanks for that call. Yeah, I think one of the prettiest words in the English language is murmurings.
Mm-hmm. Murmuration. Yeah. Murmuration. It's such a good description of the sound that the birds make as they shift direction. It's one of the most thrilling things I know is to stand under a big ball of starlings that's kind of swooshing left and right and making shapes in the sky. If you wonder about this, there are tons of great videos on YouTube. It's murmuration.
Just like it sounds.
Yep.
Do we know what they're doing?
Well, you know, they seem to do these formations toward nightfall as they're getting ready to roost. Mm-hmm. One of the certain prompts for the most spectacular formations is the presence of a predator. often something that we can't see, perhaps a peregrine falcon up high in the sky or something soaring. And the birds will coalesce into a black blob and then break apart and then reform into kind of a Möbius strip. And that seems to be sort of a, you know, the closer I fly to my buddies, the harder it's going to be for that bird to pick out one of us. So they coalesce when they perceive a threat, and then they break apart again when they feel a little bit more relaxed. But you can see them form and reform many, many different times.
You know, I've seen some photos recently from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that shows, for lack of a better word, flocks of eagles together, which seems very unusual to me. Now, of course, they're, even though they've come back really well in Ohio and all over the place, bald eagles, it's still very rare to see more than one at a time.
Well, you and I have grown up in a complete dearth of bald eagles. We're probably about the same age. And I remember as a kid wondering if I would ever see one in my lifetime.
Right.
And I lived in Richmond, Virginia at the time. And then I came back to Richmond as a young adult and saw an active nest right off the James River Bridge right in town. And it was like, conservation does work. Mm-hmm. You know, banning DDT does work. Mm-hmm. Things can come back. And that was what brought the bald eagle to near extinction, was DDT, a persistent organic chloride pesticide that broke their eggshells when ingested by the birds. So the females couldn't sit their own eggs. The shells were too thin. But yeah, in winter, I think we're just really starting to see the real bald eagle.
Yeah.
In winter, they gather at things like warm outflows of power plants and places like that, where they're going to be crippled and fish, you know, floating around, and they can gather in tremendous numbers. Now, Alaskans have always known this because the bald eagles didn't suffer quite as much, destruction from DDT in Alaska. So, you know, you see pictures of people, throwing fish to big flocks of bald eagles that look, they act like gulls, you know, they're kind of swooping in and grabbing stuff. So I think we're just starting to see what it's like to live among bald eagles, and their reproductive potential is quite high.
Let's see. Jerry in Talmadge, you're on the air. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, I have a question. For the last 4 years, we have a doe, maybe different does, we're not sure, that come and give birth in our backyard. We have a fenced yard. It's about, I guess the area is about 100 by 165 square feet. And we don't know how they get there. They must jump the fence to get in to give birth.
It.
But anyway, they seem to like the vegetation. We don't feed them. The most we've done is on a real, real dry time, we've put out a bowl with some water in it because we don't know if they're going to get enough from the vegetation. But anyway, we don't know whether it's a good idea then at some point to open the gates, whether they're there because they feel predators can't get to them. I don't want to read into knowledge that I don't know about. I'm not really sure what we should do.
You've nailed it. The deer, I was waiting for you to say that your backyard was fenced, because the deer will preferentially select a fenced yard to give birth. And this happened to my brother-in-law. He watched one give birth in his backyard right in downtown Marietta, Ohio, and it was a fenced backyard. So that's no accident. They're trying to get away from dogs, which are, of course, the worst threat to their fawns when the fawns are little and vulnerable. And so there's nothing you need to do, although I would think that once the fawn is up and walking, opening the gate would be a real good idea, because it's not going to be able to clear the fence, but the mother will lead it out the right way. Yeah. Yeah. I would also hazard a guess that it's the same doe, who is just, this is her maternity ward. This is where she comes. Yeah.
Jerry, let me ask you, do you have a dog?
No, we don't. We used to have dogs, and we miss the wildlife, but because of our increased frailty, we don't have dogs right now. We can't walk them and give them the time they need, but this just occurs, and it's nice to see.
Now you have a maternity ward, so, yeah.
Cool. That is lovely. That's amazing.
That's cool. Let's see. Nina in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nina.
Hi there. I am purchasing a 200-acre farm in southern Ohio, and my plan is to convert the approximate 100 acres of cropland into probably grasses. I'm wondering if there's anything that I should or maybe should not do to support wildlife in the area.
Oh, wow. What an opportunity. That's wonderful. You know, if it were me, I would get online and go to Ohio Prairie Nursery and get myself some seed and plant that in native Ohio prairie and see what happens. That would be an amazing thing to be able to do. You'll need to mow it, you know, periodically to keep the wood out of it, but grassland is so scarce and so precious, and the birds that come are so wonderful.
What about any kind of like birdhouses or anything like that throughout? They don't, I mean, without the woods.
Well, you could definitely host bluebirds and tree swallows. Yeah, you could put up boxes for those. I actually have a book called Natural Gardening for Birds, which would give you lots of good ideas. It's available at juliezickafoos.com. Ideas for things to plant. There are so many good native trees and shrubs that you could also plant that would attract and feed birds.
Nina, good luck with that. And, you know, next time Julie's on, if you're thinking about it and listening, let us know how it goes. I'm really interested in what you're embarking on. Karen in Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Just have two comments. One, coincidentally, as I'm sitting here on hold, a buck ran across the street and right in front of me. But that's not why I called.
Okay.
I graduated from Rice University back in the early 80s, and back then it was traditional that over the Christmas holidays, the cowbirds descended. We were like their end point for roosting over the winter. This is Rice University in Houston. And so you had to learn to live with millions of cowbirds. Mm-hmm. And like being very, very quiet when you walked underneath the trees, staying away from certain areas. The president's house had alarms and sirens going off to scare them away. And then when spring came, because as in roosting situations, some birds die. And so when spring came, they started mowing the lawn. And so you had bits of bird everywhere. The smell was horrendous.
Oh, gosh.
So,
wow.
And then we were very satisfied when a number of years later, we found out the birds weren't going to Rice anymore. They stopped at Texas A&M.
I guess that's a rival.
Yeah. Now, being on the receiving end of these massive wintering blackbirds is fun. I know that for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
But that
story
was their natural direction.
Must have been where they wound up. Yeah. Yeah. Crazy.
Kieran, thanks a lot for that call. I'm interested. Real quick, you only have about a minute left, but when we talked to you in July, you were in the midst of a large construction project out and creating an outdoor room, sort of, and I followed it. You achieved your goal. It was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I'll tell you, when you put your mind to something, you do it, girl.
Yeah, I do, and I've got the bruises to prove it. I've got bruises all up and down my legs today from the battle with honeysuckle yesterday. And I do look at it as making room. I create spaces that I would want to inhabit out of tangles of jungly vine. And that's my quarantine thing. You know, that's what keeps me happy and smiling.
Well, keep smiling, Julie Zickafoos. I can't wait to talk to you again. Thanks so much for your time today.
I always love talking with you, Ann.
That's Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, and author of several books, including the 2019 title, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. If you want to learn about all of her other books and follow her blog and so on, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and you'll get all the Julie Zickafoos there is out there. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.